So my name is Jeffrey Higgins. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. It's a pleasure to have you all here. This is Elaine's is owned by my wife, Cynthia. This is all of her food based on her family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt, and we've turned it into a literary hub for the D.C. area. You are author number 173 that I've interviewed since we've opened. We have a podcast. It's Elaine's Literary Salon. If you go to elainesliterarysalon.com, you can find our upcoming schedule. And see, I think we're up to 40-something podcasts at this point, so they're really a lot of fun. We get a lot of New York Times number one bestsellers. It's really interesting. And if you're an author or know an author and are interested, reach out to me, jeffrey@jeffreyjameshiggins.com, and we'll schedule time to do an event for you. So I'm excited about today. This should be a lot of fun. I love having poets in here. We do a lot of poetry readings, by the way. We were going to have another one sometime this spring. I haven't scheduled it yet, so we'll make sure we touch base for that.
Yeah, thanks.
For years, Bonnie Narodze has led weekly poetry sessions for street sense vendors in a meeting room behind an Episcopal church, at Miriam's Kitchen in a Presbyterian church basement, and in a retirement center all in Washington, D.C. Her poems have appeared in Agni, New Letters, Rhino, Kenyon Review, the Georgia Review, Tampa Review, Epic, wow, all the ones, right? The Dappled Things, and other journals, while racking up numerous pushcart nominations, which is a really big deal. In 2010, she won the University of New Orleans Poetry Prize, which was a month's stay in the South Tyrol castle of Ezra Pound's daughter, Mary. There, she enjoyed having tea with Mary, hiking in the Dolomites, eating polenta, and reading Pound's early poetry. Bonnie has an MFA in poetry, an MA from Harvard, and more recently, an MA from the Graduate Institute, St. John's College in Annapolis. Invited to Feast is her debut poetry collection. Please welcome Bonnie Narodze. So congratulations, first off. It's a really big deal finishing any kind of book or collection or anthology. Everybody thinks they have one in them, and then when they realize how long it takes to actually get to the end. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. And I can't wait to read your thrillers.
Oh, thank you. So I'm just curious, like, you have quite a few poems in here. How much do you think, collectively, how much time did this take you to put all this work together?
Well, Jeffrey, that's a very good question. Some of the poems I wrote some time ago. For instance, I have a poem in here about teaching my daughter how to ride a bicycle. And she's now in her 40s. But what happened was I had a manuscript full of enough poems to publish when I earned my MFA in poetry. And I sent it around, and nobody wanted it. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to submit individual poems, get them published, and see how they stand in pretty well-known journals. And I'll also keep writing new poems. And so I started revising the manuscript, the original one, until it basically was completely different by the time it was published. And even after it was accepted for publication by Slant Books, I found that I was rewriting, turning the poems around into different orders, revising, changing. So, does that help?
Sure, yeah, and it begs the question, like, when is a work done? When are you finished writing? Because it's a very common thing with all writers, right? If I go back and read something I wrote like 2 weeks ago, I'm tearing it apart again.
Oh, you are. Well, then I think you have the answer. It's never finished. It's finished when you put it down and don't pick it up again. And I can tell you that once this was published, I thought, I can't write poems now because it wasn't coming to me. And then I started finally writing new poems that were relevant and important to me. So, it's never finished.
My answer for that is always when my publisher says it's due now, like that's
like
when
that
goes, or when I literally can't look at it one more time, like when both of those things happen.
Both of those work, yeah.
So you mentioned, your daughter riding a bicycle. So this is 30 plus years ago, right? And so when you're doing that, and then you look at something 30 years later, you've changed as a person, you've changed as a writer, you have different skill sets. How does that affect the writing? Let me phrase it a different way. Does it affect the writing in that it really cuts the heart out of the feeling that you were trying to convey with that item, or is it just you're maybe giving a better job of reaching those emotions you're trying to evoke?
Well, I hope it's the latter. But I think that in the case of that poem, which, by the way, was published by Ron Charles from the Washington Post book column when he still had a job there, but now he's on Substack. I think that it's that poem is sort of timeless because it shows a, sort of a relationship between a mother and child, and the child growing up and going away, the mother trying to hold on, and there's this uncertainty, and yet things happen. So I think that the poems I write now sort of include the feelings I have always had, but I have a better better way of expressing them that's truer to the way I feel now. Does that help?
Absolutely. So I think your strategy of trying to get published in magazines and journals is what a lot of really successful poets do, because you're winning prizes, you're getting a platform, people are realizing the quality of your work. But so when you reach that point and then you want to put a collection together, how do you select what goes into it?
Well, I wanted to have a balance, because I knew that the manuscript had a lot of themes in it, and so I tried to select the ones that were most meaningful and that weren't repetitive, and that expressed my emotions. I can tell you that when I'm writing about a specific person, like an elegy, the words come more quickly and they hit home because I'm very much focused on the person I'm writing about and the person I'm writing for. If I write something more general, then it's harder to make those words ring true.
You mentioned the themes. What are the themes that run through this collection?
Well, one of them is teaching poetry with homeless people or people on the margins. And I learned so much from them. I've had I have a good deal of poems in the collection about them, working with them, and my life changing because of their work. And also I have two poems in here about the time I was teaching poetry in a prison, the D.C. Women's Jail. One poem about that, and then one poem about working with immigrants. So those are some themes. And then there are themes about reading books and trying to relate the books to my life. And I guess those are some of the main ones.
And you have the book broken up into three sections. I'm curious because, you know, poems are different, right? By nature, every poem is different. It has a different subject matter. It has a different feeling. You were experiencing something different when you wrote it. So when people are putting them together in collections, I'm always really interested how they see them. You know, what is the connective tissue? So what are these three sections, and why did you do that?
Well, each section starts with a kind of an epigraph. And I tried to have some similarity among each of the three sections. So some people will divide up poetry books into sections which are quite discrete. I wanted to have each of the themes in each of the poetry divisions. And I always made sure to end with a poem to Marcus Aurelius, because I thought, well, if the poems seem disorderly in some ways because of the groupings, at least I have Marcus Aurelius to end each of the sections. I hope that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. That's really interesting, too. I did not predict that answer, so that's really good. So, how does it feel having the book together like that and having a collection? Because it's sort of a different market than you might get from just journals and things. Tell us about that kind of debut poetry collection experience for you.
Well, what can I say? I'm glad I have a book out. And I remember the experience of, well, what do I do now? Is this the end? Is this the end of my life? there was this pause, and then I thought, I'm going to start another one, because there's more. There's more to it.
That started to go really dark all of a sudden. So I'm glad it had a happy ending. Yikes.
It's still having a happy ending.
Wonderful. So why don't you read one of the poems? I think when you're doing poetry, you can talk about it, but you really have to read something so people have a feeling for your voice.
Oh, by the way, I hope you do read the epigraphs. The first one is from Wittgenstein. And the second one's from Rilke and so on. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
No, you're holding the book.
Okay.
You can hold both. Okay.
I could read it, too.
I wouldn't mind that. All right, so this is the first poem in the book, and it's called Paradise in the Day Shelter. Am I projecting okay?
You are projecting. We good back there? Excellent.
All right. What they liked best was the poem about a paradise you can conceal in your pocket so no one will steal it. I got one.
You got it?
Queenie, who stows her hearing aids in a Ziploc bag in her pocket, asks what free verse is. It's verse you don't have to pay for, Chuck tells her. Paul asks if paradise is a place. Mo shakes his head and says, it's a sleeping bag at night that can turn into a jacket in the morning. Leon, who sleeps nearby on the steps outside St. Paul's, thinks paradise could be a place to live, a tent or a camper. You'd need a big pocket for that, I say. Saul asks, if I see it, will I recognize it? Carl says, if you speak of paradise, you must consider hell and the duality of existence. Well, Jimmy Buffett sang of cheeseburgers in paradise, Eugenia replies, and a slice of onion is heaven on earth. Thank you.
That's terrific.
I noticed I was holding the book up.
What's that?
I noticed I was holding the book up. That's not good.
No, you are fine. The important thing is they hear it. They all know you're here. Okay. So I want to ask you, you mentioned free verse. Besides being free, like, what is the difference between free verse and prose?
Well, I thought you were going to ask what's the difference between free verse and forms or unfree verse, but in fact, I'm going to answer your question. What's the difference between prose and poetry? Can I put it that way?
Please, yeah.
Okay, we can start with that. And that is that if your poem or a poem you read doesn't follow a certain form, like a sonnet or pantoum, so on, then the only difference is what's called the line break. Where do you break the line? Because with prose, you go from the left margin to the right margin, right? And with poetry, you break the line before you get to the right margin. And so it's an important decision where you decide to break the line. That's free verse. And because there are no guardrails. Generally, you don't want to break it in a funny place syntactically, So you don't want to break it in the middle of a prepositional phrase, for instance. Because if somebody reads to the end of the line and it ends with the reader is thinking, what's going on here? So it just makes it easier for the reader if you have these syntactical phrase breaks.
Yeah, I'm always interested to hear how people make these distinctions, right? Because there are literary authors actually I had someone here yesterday whose stuff was, I mean, her actual prose were beautiful, and it read like poetry, right? But it's prose. And so, like taking your definition, what about an author who uses, like, M dashes or sentence fragments as a way to break up the rhythm of what they're writing? It's still prose, but that sort of it's similar to what you're describing.
You're right. Okay, so there's another definition that some people use that avoids that kind of discussion, and that is that poetry is the best words in the best order. And so when you think, okay, what's the difference between prose and poetry? Sometimes a person who is responding to a poem will say, I don't know, that line is kind of flat. It seems so prosy. So I think that people recognize the difference between a poetic line and a prosy or prose line, no matter if the line goes to the end of the page or not. Does that help?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. But I think also people can use those same techniques in prose.
They can.
You know, that you can see. And it depends on how literary the writing is. Because obviously in poetry, every word counts. And you don't have much real estate, right? And in writing maybe a 400-page novel, you have a little more leeway. But yeah. I think people can still, with literary, can still do it. So I'm always curious, because I've had a lot of different answers for that.
You want me to continue answering?
Please.
Okay, so so there are different ways of having line breaks in poetry and in prose, as you said. And I think that there's this middle space between poetry and prose, and it's called the prose poem, which people are writing more and more. And then there's also flash fiction, or very short fiction. And so I think in all those cases, it's legitimate. It's not against the law to produce line breaks or spaces to signify to the reader this is a time to pause in any number of ways, as you said. I'm sure your thriller has a lot of those.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's a spectrum, right, of the literary techniques that writers use. But I think at some point the line gets really blurred, you know, and I'm always curious. So, like, I meant to ask you, in your bio, it says you spent time at Ezra Pound's castle, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
Well, his daughter's castle.
His daughter's castle, but
although he did live there.
Okay, so, but he really kind of created, like, the modern poem in a lot of ways, right, in free verse. It was very influential in that, and kind of breaking that, the meter and the rhythm and some of the forms that you were talking about earlier. So, two questions. One, how much did he and his writing influence you? Let's start there.
Well... It's interesting because I think that his friend T.S. Eliot writing influenced me a lot more. Pound was interesting because he actually took the wasteland and cut it a lot. So we will never see the complete version of the wasteland, which must have been awfully long. But Pound always said, make it new. And some of his early translations are just transcendent. He did translate some early Anglo-Saxon poems. So he also wrote these very, very long cantos. And so there was a variety in what he wrote. And maybe one lesson was to never to stay with one form, but to to evolve, to make your writing different, so that you have an arc to your writing, and you're not just stuck.
Yeah, so my other question is, how do you separate, like, the person from the artist and the art from the person, right? Because obviously, you know, rabid anti-Semite, fascist, right? Arrested for treason, like, all that kind of stuff, right? Mm. Really kind of just horrible monster of a human being. Yet,
Ezra Pound, he's talking about.
Ezra, not you. No, you're fine. She's... You know, but then he's so influential in poetry, right? And worked with, like, what, Hemingway, and I mean, he worked with a lot of poets and authors as well, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you say, I always wonder where that, like, Overton window is, you know, where people were at some point you can still look at the art.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I often ask myself how I can reconcile those differences. And the early Pound was different from the later Pound. It was the later Pound who was who got on these radio programs and talked about how everybody should follow Mussolini. And so and I prefer the earlier Pound's writings anyway. So I don't know if I can reconcile those two qualities. But it wasn't just Pound. Even T.S. Eliot, they say, had anti-Semitic writings.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer. But I think that you can still be swayed by the quality of the writing of poetry, no matter the, the personal life of the writer.
Yeah, interesting question, right? So, when you're, I'm curious about the actual nuts and bolts, because writing poetry is really difficult, right? So when, how does, like, the inspiration or the idea come, in something that you realize you want to express through poetry, like, right from the beginning? How does that come to you?
It comes in different ways, and thank you for asking that. You're asking me these imponderable questions. I can only tell you that I wrote a pantoum during the pandemic called Lines. And it's in the book. And I remember very clearly standing in line outside Trader Joe's. And, you know, that was when they had these little circles 6 feet from each other, and you had to stand in the circle and keep your distance. And it's just a poem started to come to me about standing in line. And this has been done before, standing in line for a long time. And I started thinking about the other situations, like standing in line during the Depression, waiting for a job or hoping for a job. And standing in line in other places. So they come in different ways. And sometimes they come in response to a prompt that I have to write towards, and it's always a surprise what comes out. For instance, a teacher, David Keplinger, who teaches at American University, gave a prompt, write about the day you were born. Which is in here. And I asked a friend, well, how am I going to do that? And he said, well, just look for a newspaper and get the issue that was the day you were born. And I did. It kind of freed me up to say what was happening. Just so you know, I was kind of born during the end of World War II. And there was still a lot going on in that context. And then somehow, if you have to write something, it frees you up. But if you don't have to write something, you wait until something comes to you, if you have that luxury.
Do you think people are born storytellers in that, you know, you have these prompts or just parts of life experience that's becoming a prompt for you. Do you think people, certain people just automatically think of that in a way to turn that into story? Or is that something you learn and enjoy story and then start looking for fodder?
Well, well, that's another very good question. I think it's both. Okay, so one way is the story comes to you. The other way is that people provide the story. Well, maybe that's the same way. But in this case of the poem I read, Paradise in the Day Shelter, it just kind of came alive because of the dialogue that was going on. And I must have just written it all down as it was happening, or some shortly afterwards, and the poem just came to me. And they were responding to a poem we just read by Roger Robinson, who is from Trinidad and London, and that the name of the his poem was Paradise in Your Pocket. That became the name of his prize-winning poetry collection that won the T.S. Eliot Prize. So that was kind of handed to me on a platter. It was an opportunity that I couldn't pass by. But then there are poems that you direct to happen. That's the best I can think of.
So when this just comes to you, do you feel like you're channeling it? Do you feel like it already somehow exists and it's coming through you?
Well, I love that question. And I think you framed it really well because I don't know whether storytelling is really indigenous to the process, but I think that there are times when it just comes and then I respond.
I love that. So when you're actually creating it, do you do it like maybe a prose writer who writes the whole thing quickly to get an idea of what you're trying to say? Or are you painstakingly going word by word and listening to the rhythm as you write?
Well, I think the recommendation is write it down, use half a page of prose or more, and then look at what you have, and then circle the lines or phrases that seem to best express what you want to say. And then go from there. But first you want to get the story down. And there are two kinds of poetry. There's narrative poetry, think Dante. And then there's lyric poetry, think of Emily Dickinson. And then there's a mixture. And mostly poems are a mixture of narrative and lyric. And then there's dramatic poetry, which is also persona poetry. So,
I love the definitions because it always feels like the starting point where we can start talking about all the exceptions, right? So, like when even in genre, like in prose, right? There's all the genres. Any story usually has four or five different genres included in it. In your poetry, don't you have a little bit of different forms as well? Because I mean, they certainly are narrative. You know, you're telling stories as you go.
Yeah, okay, so different forms. I can think of a poem where I was writing about my father, and there were, it was called Elegy with Contrails. He was an Air Force pilot. And so there's this narrative, it's a story of parts of his life. But then there are these phrases like looking up into the sky and seeing contrails and thinking of him. And so I think it's a mix.
Do you want to read us another poem?
I would love to. I'm going to read it now.
Okay, wonderful.
Here we go again. Get down. Put these on. All right. So I'm going to read this poem called Lines, which I mentioned to you. It came to me while I was standing in line. This has been done for a long time. Standing in line. Oh, sorry. This has been done before, standing in line for a long time. Think of Soviet women who queued for hours for bread. And I have learned about the lines of the Great Depression. Men lined up for mind-numbing jobs at assembly lines. Think of Soviet women who stood for hours for bread. Or Akhmatova outside the prison waiting for news of her son. Men lined up for mind-numbing jobs at assembly lines. These days, some have it easy. Food deliveries, yoga online. Akhmatova outside the prison waited with women for news and the chance to send a loaf of bread or a note inside. These days, some have it easy. Food deliveries, yoga online. Still, Camus said the plague is within us, here to stay. I have learned about the lines of the Great Depression, where hope envisions a loaf of bread, a note from inside. Camus wrote that the plague is within us, here to stay, as it has always done, waiting in line for a long time. Is that it? Thank you. So that's just a sample, but I wanted to give you an example of poem in a certain form, and you've probably heard the repetitions, and it's a certain form that can go on forever, but it's always four lines, and with slight changes, so they make sense. And so that's a poem that you can't do in prose because somebody would read it and say, wait, I just read that. It's like,
there is a rule of threes in prose where people can do that to drive a point home.
Oh.
But it's difficult to do properly.
Okay. Yes. I want to learn more about that. Hmm.
So did you always want to be a poet?
No. I wrote poetry, but there were times I wanted to do other things more. And but I always come back to it. And somebody, is it this writer's group? I think it was in Swanee, and I was trying to explain why I wrote poems instead of longer pieces. And the person figured that I had, ADD? And so you had to write something short before your attention was pulled away. And she told me about medication that you could take for ADD. So you could stick through and write a long piece. I don't know. I think that a poem is a shorter form which has so many variations that it's enough for me.
I'm curious, why are people, in your opinion, drawn to poetry? Like, why is it that poetry brings out such emotion or people connect to it?
Well, that's a really good question because I'm not sure that's only in poetry. And I can think now of these 15-page papers I wrote for when I was at St. John's College and the Graduate Institute. I loved writing those papers. The one about Moby Dick, one about the Odyssey, and so on and so on. And so there's a lot of power in writing. Of course, it was only 15 pages, not like a novel. But I think that poetry, as I was trying to say earlier, limits you to a certain size unless you're writing cantos or the Divine Comedy. And so you have this challenge of staying within a certain size, and that helps. When you push against a challenge, it helps your creativity somehow.
What do you do to like to stoke that creativity?
I drink coffee. No.
That works, doesn't it?
Well, I have to tell you that experiences in the world help a lot. Rilke wrote this in Letters to a Young Poet. Go out and experience the world. And ask yourself questions. And don't be in a hurry to answer them. I find that when I'm out in the world, like traveling and experiencing something for the first time, I'm more likely to want to capture it in poetry.
So do you think, like, because that's a very human experience, right? You're experiencing things other people can, so there's some universality to it. Do you think, how do you think, like, in this world of artificial intelligence, when people are using it for writing, how do you think that separates what you're doing from what something that would be created by AI does?
Well, I don't know much about AI, except it really annoys me when I... it's not when I get a... I don't know about you, but when I get an email now, it tells me how to respond and what words to use. Well, okay, sorry. I think that the experience has to stand on its own and I think that it'll come through. I think it'll break through the fourth dimension.
So when you're a professional poet and you're a wordsmith, how much does it annoy you when you're doing those emails and AI's telling you how to say something?
Well, I'm not a professional poet, but I have to tell you, somebody asked me, why do you want to have a book of poems published? Did you need the money? All right. Sorry. It's funny. I said earlier, best words in the best order. And there's a certain satisfaction in finding words that work the best. And I don't want it taken away from me by some artificial intelligence which is telling me what to say in a very bland way.
Yeah, I mean, so you think the poetry really is unique to what is human, and that it's not just your experience, right? But it's the feeling that you get from it. And certainly AI can't feel that.
Yes, and I think that has to be our way going forward. Humanity has to be able to express itself in terms of reality.
So you mentioned earlier, like, a reading to in prisons and reading to the homeless. Tell us a little about that project where you're reading. When you're talking about reading to the homeless, are these people going through, like, transitional homelessness? Or who is the audience?
Yeah, it's not exactly reading to them. It's more like bringing a pocket full of poems, which I call a handout. And which is, I thought it was funny because I'm saying, would you like a handout?
We're with
you. they put their hand down. They don't want a, you know, printed poems. But anyway, so it's sort of an interrelational experience of taking turns reading the poems to each other that I have brought, and then hopefully some people will write their own. I also bring lined paper and pens and stuff. And so it's a very inclusive kind of experience. And sometimes there are poems that I bring that can really reach out, I hate to say this, but reach out and touch someone and open up possibilities.
When you bring paper and pencils, do people do poetry while they're at these events? Have you seen that happen, or have you lit the spark? Or are people starting to do poetry because of this?
Well, okay, so at the Street Sense, which is one of the places I've been going for years now, every Monday morning, the vendors get sort of extra credit if they write a poem that then appears in a issue of Street Sense. And yes, there is time for them to write, and I come prepared for writing materials. And so I try to bring poems that will spark their imagination and touch their daily lives in a way that they will respond by writing something.
Have you had feedback from them? Is poetry helping them in any way?
I have had feedback from some people, and I think that there are many aspects of poetry that can help. And one is that it's something that you can share. It's an experience that people can respond to. The poem is short enough so that we can... I bring 4 pages, so whatever fits into 4 pages. And I bring information about the poet and so on. So I think that to answer your question, it has helped people. They can come to a space where they feel they can be themselves, and they can feel free to write. And a lot of what they write comes out of their experiences. And it's freeing, I think, to be able to write about your experience that you might not have thought you could.
And you mentioned that it affected you, too. Has it changed your poetry in any way?
Because I'm beginning to see poetry more and more as a communal experience. And I want to write about it in that way.
And how did you get into bringing poetry into prisons? You mentioned a women's prison.
Yeah, the D.C. Women's Jail. It was in the 2A reentry unit, I just called. And I did that because when I got my MFA in poetry, somebody said, okay, now you have to teach. Well, I was working full-time, and I thought, I don't want to do that. Go to a community college or something. And then a friend of mine who had been wanting to teach with me in prisons had encouraged me to follow that avenue. And so I applied to be a volunteer. And I just felt that I had an MFA in poetry, and I needed to go teach. So that's what brought me originally to it. There's another reason, I'll try to be quick, and that is that I was at this place called Holy Cross Abbey, which is in Berryville, Virginia. And there's a priest there who's also a monk who I would go meet with for half an hour because you can sign up. And I said to him, how can I be more devoted Catholic? And he said, well, you can start by going to Mass more than once a week. And truly, I said, oh, I don't mean that. I didn't know you could go more than once a week. Anyway, I said social justice. And so he said that when he was stationed in D.C., he volunteered at prisons, and he worked with a woman from the British Embassy who was teaching knitting. And he said what he noticed was that the women who were learning how to knit used the opportunity to talk with each other, to tell each other their stories. And so I thought, oh, okay, I'll bring poems and stories to the women's prison and see how it goes. And it went so well. The only reason I stopped You can actually take the metro to the D.C. jail. I'm sure you know that. But so, and I would go straight from work. The only reason I stopped was that I had picked up these other opportunities. And if you want to be a volunteer in the D.C. jail system, you have to get 2 recommendations every year, and you have to refill out all these forms, and you have to get these tests, like a TB test and other tests. And it's, that's the only reason I stopped.
So we're going to go to some audience questions. But before I do, I just want to ask you, you're working on a new book. Is a new collection of poems? Mm-hmm. And is this, are these all new poems, or are these poems that you publish elsewhere that you're bringing together?
They're all new, mostly, yeah. And I'm hoping for a more of a continuous theme this time, but I'm still working on that.
Oh, that's fun. Okay, I'm going to come around with the microphone. Does anybody have a question?
I was talking about you.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Christine.
Coming down here on the train, I ran into a young man who's kind of helping me find my way. And he asked where I was going. So I told him where I was going, and I told him, he asked for your name and the title of your book. And in a few minutes, he looks up from his phone and says, "Okay, I ordered it." So made a sale, get credit for that, finder's fee. He told me then, he says, "I'm not very well read." And the first thing that went through my head is there's so much allusion and reference to writers and pieces of literature that aren't explained exactly. And I thought, oh no, he's not going to understand this poetry. But correct me, Bonnie. Is this poetry not accessible to those who are not well read?
Well, I would like to say, oh yes. some more accessible than others. For instance, poems that are about family. Everybody has family at one time or another. Those are very accessible, I think.
I thought about your poems we talked about yesterday, the ones that use lines from common work, and I thought, first of all, I thought, he's not going to understand that at all. But then he doesn't have to know the King's, letter from the Birmingham jail. He'll still hear the words for the first time.
Yeah.
So I was kind of struggling there on the train whether what kind of impact this poetry would have on a young man who's not well read.
Thank you. So in my book there's some poems where I used technique by Ann Carson, who's a brilliant poet and translator. And what she did was she had translated an ancient Greek poem, and she noticed that it had a certain pattern to it. On the one hand, on the other hand, "nay, rather." And you can look up her essay on it, "nay, rather." Okay, and so she started using that framework to translate. I guess it's called a cento when you take lines from somebody else's work, and of course you have to explain that you did do that. It's not your own work. But the first one I chose to try that out was King's letter from the Birmingham jail. On the one hand, on the other hand, "nay, rather." Now, he didn't say that exactly, but it fit. And so that's what Christine is asking about. It's in the book. And so I realized if I took fairly short pieces that were very interesting to me, I could see if I could take some of those lines and make them into a very intriguing poem. I think in my notes at the end of the book, I think I mentioned that Ann Carson actually used instructions for how to take the London train for one of them, and another one she was using instructions for her new washing machine or something like that. So you can use different phrases. That was kind of funny that she was actually using phrases that were very important and serious. And that's kind of a framework that you can experiment with. Thank you. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Unless someone else has a question, I have kind of a follow-up. I'm chatty. So this has inspired me to try this technique with a book I just read, The Tempest, Shakespeare's The Tempest. Now, not many of us can write poetry that anyone is going to publish, but I would like to know, is there a value to writing poetry when you know it's never going to get published, and maybe other people aren't really going to enjoy it? But just, is there a value in doing it? Should we go do something else?
Oh, there's always a value in writing poetry or anything that is important to you. If it's not important to you, why do it, right? But some people have a journaling technique, and sometimes I'll write something and I'll think, oh, this is just what I did today, and then something will come out of that, or it'll come to you from your experiences. Remember, I mentioned Rilke before. So I think, yes, there is definitely a value to it. Because in the end, I do think that poetry is a communal activity that you want to share with others. But first, you want to work on it yourself. So it goes from private to communal. Thank you.
We have other questions over here. Anybody?
Hey, Bonnie. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to know, I think in our area, but I live here, so I don't know about other areas, but it's so focused on success and worldly achievement and so on. And you work with these populations that are different. So I wonder if you have any reflections on the populations that you work with and just how their intrinsic humanity and their value and their wisdom come through for you, in spite of the lack of these outward success markers that we maybe mistakenly value?
I don't know. Those outside markers sort of fall away and become less important when you're working with poetry in a group. It's amazing what people can share and what it evokes. I'll tell you as a sideline, I write political poetry, or I guess a better way to say it is topical poetry, and so I'll send it to this blog called Newverse News, and the thing they published most recently of mine was a pentum, not this one, but a more topical one. Okay.
So I'm going to have you read your last poem. And
yes.
Where should people find you? Where do you want people who are watching this to go find your work?
All I can say is I have a website, and I can't tell you where else.
What is the website address?
I think that if you type in Bonnie Narace with no capital letters and no dot or anything, it'll come up. It'll come up as Bonnie Narace Poetry.
All right, and it's on Amazon, I know, too.
Oh, everything's on Amazon.
Okay, fantastic. All right, do you want to read your one more poem?
Thanks. All right. Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, so, as I said, each section of the book ends with a meditation from Marcus Aurelius, and this last poem in the book is called Meditation Filling Our Lives. Here's the quote. Do not wander from your path any longer, for you are not likely to read your notebooks or your deeds of ancient Rome and Greece, or your extracts from their writings, which you have laid up against old age. Marcus Aurelius. The future comes in the guise of spring rising all around after the rain ends and you've planted bulbs into the ground. Toss out last year's odds and ends. The life you dreamed about is here. think of veering completely off the rails or going out another way, like those disciples on the way to Emmaus, because you will meet a stranger on your journey, as they must, and invite the stranger to a feast, which is where you need to be. Aurelius died near the Danube, far from Rome, and here you are, perplexed by how to part with rooms full of possessions, notebooks. Jesus beckons to a tax collector to come with him. Matthew looks surprised, points to himself, and asks, "Who, me?" Then he rises, goes with him to the banquet. When we are empty, we fill our lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I always ask people if they have a second to go on just Amazon and rate her work. It really helps when people are looking to find a new writer. And also, if you would do the same for our restaurant, we'd appreciate it. And please go to elainesliterarysalon.com, sign up for a newsletter. You'll get our schedule. We've two of these this weekend. We usually do at least one a week, sometimes up to four a week. So it's really a lot of fun. And you have books here for sale, correct?
Yep.
Okay, she has books up here. So if you'd like to get a book signed, please do that. Thank you so much, Bonnie. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.